touches John's skin. "What's she doing?" Sarah gasps. For a moment, John looks puzzled. He starts to say something, but his eyes roll back in his head, and his body contorts, like all his muscles are cramping up at once. Then, as if all the tension goes out of him, he collapses like a puppet with his strings cut, right onto the floor next to Ella's bed.
"John!"
Sarah shouts. Ella's hand is still clamped around John's wrist. Nine lunges into the room.
"Get her off him!"
Marina blocks Nine's way.
"Wait, don't touch her!"
Not listening, Sarah reaches down and pries Ella's hand off John's wrist. He doesn't move, doesn't come to at all. Even when Sarah rolls him over and shakes him, whatever Ella's touch did to John apparently doesn't have the same effect on humans, because Sarah is unaffected. Six steps forward to look closer, and I see Ella's hand reaching up towards her, fingers clenching and unclenching. "Watch it," I say, and grab Six by the back of the shirt, pulling her backwards. The rest of the guard notice Ella's grasping hand, and everyone takes a cautious step away from the bed. As soon as there aren't any guard within reach, her hand drops lifelessly back to the bed. She looks just like she did before, trapped in a nightmare. Except now, John has joined her.
"What the hell is going on?"
Nine asks.
"She did something to him,"
breathes Five. Sarah cradles John's head in her lap, stroking his hair. Nearby, my dad gently lifts Ella's hands and tucks them under the covers. I look over at the guard. They're used to being on the run, to physical threats that they can fight and destroy. But how are they supposed to escape, or defeat, something that attacks them from within? Chapter 30. Nobody gets any sleep that night. Well, except for the two of us that can't be woken up. And that's a sleep I don't think anyone is eager to join. My dad and I lifted John onto the bed next to Ella, laying them side by side, the two of them sporadically thrashing. Sarah refuses to leave the room. She holds John's hand, stroking it gently, trying to coax him awake. Bernie Kosar won't leave either. He lies curled up at the foot of the bed, whining occasionally, nuzzling John and Ella's feet. I poke my head into the room a few hours after John first collapsed. Sarah has her head down, pressed to the back of John's hand. I'm not sure if she's asleep or not, and I don't want to disturb her. Nothing has changed with John and Ella. Their facial muscles twitch, and their bodies occasionally lurch as if they've just tripped in a dream and are scrambling for their balance. I've had those dreams before, the ones where you trip or fall off a bike, and I always wake up before I hit the ground. That doesn't seem to be the case for John and Ella. I take a closer look at John. It has only been a few hours, but already his skin has taken on a pallor similar to Ella's, dark circles forming around his eyes. It's almost as if he's being drained somehow. Now that I think about it, Ella looked pretty washed out before training this morning. I'm worried there's some kind of physical aspect to the nightmares, like they're weakening John and Ella, or worse.
"Sarah,"
I whisper, and then realize there's no point in keeping quiet. We want these two to wake up. I should be banging on pots and pans.
"Everyone's getting together in the living room."
Sarah stirs, shaking her head.
"I'm going to stay here,"
she says quietly.
"I don't want to leave them."
I nod, and don't press the issue. I leave the room and head over to the workshop, where my dad has spent the rest of the night hunched over a computer. When I enter, language samples are scrolling by on the screen, but it doesn't look like he's any closer to cracking those Mogadorian documents.
"Anything?" I ask.
"Not yet," he replies, turning to face me. He has to blink a few times, his eyes dilated from staring at the screen.
"I've worked up an auto-decoder, so I don't have to sit here monitoring the progress. It's pretty, old school. I'm a little behind the times when it comes to software, but it should be able to crack it eventually. I only hope it's quick enough.
I glance at the scanned Mogadorian pages. You think any of this is related to the nightmares?
I don't know. The timing certainly seems convenient.
Yeah. I notice my dad's cell phone sitting out on the desk. I tap it. Were you trying Adam again? I didn't think it was possible, but my dad's face droops even farther.
Yes. No progress there, either.
I pat him on the shoulder. Come on. The others are meeting and want us to join them. The remaining guard are waiting in the penthouse living room. They're already discussing the nightmare situation, which is pretty much what we've been doing for the last couple hours without making any progress.
Ella did that to me before,
Marina is saying, her voice hushed.
Sucked me into her dream. I should have warned him. Should have warned everyone. But I was touching her before, when I first tried to wake her up, and nothing happened. I was in such a panic.
Sitting next to her on the couch, 8 puts his arm around Marina's shoulders. She leans against him as he says,
It's okay. You couldn't have known this would happen.
9 is pacing back and forth across the length of the room, which is actually an improvement over him pacing across the ceiling. He'd probably still be wearing a track into the space around the chandelier if 6 hadn't snapped at him for being annoying. For once, he didn't bother with a comeback and simply resumed his pacing somewhere less obtrusive. He looks up at me hopefully when I re-enter.
Well?
9 asks. I shake my head.
No change. They still haven't woken up.
5 slaps his hands on his legs in frustration.
This sucks. I feel useless sitting here.
6's brow was knit in consternation when I first entered, but she looks up when 5 speaks. She nods her head, slowly, considering.
We should talk about that.
About what? Marina asks.
About continuing on with the mission. 5's chest isn't going to recover itself.
9 stops pacing, considering what 6 has just said. Marina looks aghast at the notion of going on a mission.
You want to leave now? Marina asks. Have you gone crazy?
6 is right, 5 jumps in.
We're not doing any good sitting around here. Our friends are in there comatose, and you just want to leave them?
Hisses Marina.
You make it sound cold, but I'm just trying to be practical, 6 says.
It sounds similar to what she was telling me on the roof, how she's reluctant to start a relationship because of that moment where things go to shit. It seems like that moment is here.
It is practical, but that doesn't mean it's right,
I murmur. I don't mean to say that out loud, but it's been a long night, and there's a lot on my mind. A shadow of hurt passes over 6's face, but it's gone as soon as she looks away from me. She turns to 9.
What do you think?
I don't know, 9 says. I don't like abandoning John and the squirt.
If even 9's backing down from a mission, then you know it's not the right idea, snaps Marina, sounding exasperated. What if they need us, 6?
We wouldn't be abandoning them, 5 says, his voice level. At least, we wouldn't be abandoning them any more than we are by sitting out here having this pointless discussion. The humans will take care of them, just like they are now.
Absolutely, my dad says. We'll do everything we can.
We need to figure out why this is happening, Marina says. If not what's causing the nightmares, then what Ella did to knock out John.
Did you guys notice the way her hand glowed when she touched him? I ask. It was like a legacy or something.
What kind of legacy does that?
9 asks, pointing towards the bedroom.
John thought she used some new legacy to scare off Cetricus Ra in New Mexico, Marina says, thinking this through. We never had a chance to test it.
Or it could be her telepathy gone crazy. Maybe she got in his head and lost control, suggests 8. She's only just started getting her legacies. Who knows what she might be capable of?
I think back to our time in Paradise, remembering how much work it took John to control his lumen over those first few weeks. It seems like Ella's telepathy would be an even more difficult legacy to master. I notice 5 nodding his head slowly, as if he's remembering something too. Back when I first developed my Externa, I had problems changing my skin back to normal, Five says. Albert used this prism thing for my chest, and it helped, I don't know, relax me somehow. I was able to change my skin back. Six points at Five. There you go, another argument for going to the Everglades to get whatever that was. Nine nods in agreement.
I can't believe it, but you actually might be onto something, Five.
Five holds his hands up.
Well, wait. I don't even know if it would work on Ella, or how it works.
I still don't think we should leave them like this, says Marina.
Actually, I think separating all of you from John and Ella is a good idea,
my dad says.
Who's to say this couldn't start spreading somehow? Especially if it's related to her telepathy. We can't afford to have any more of you in a catatonic state.
How do we fight this?
Nine asks, gruffly, his brow furrowed, probably having exhausted all the possible ways to punch out a nightmare.
I mean, if Cetrica's Ra can just put us into some dream coma, how are we supposed to fight back against that?
He's come at us with these dreams before, says Eight. We woke up. No problem.
It's different this time, Marina insists.
Last time Johnny woke up, Nine says. That means this shit got stronger.
Or maybe the difference is Ella, says Six. Maybe Cetricus Ra has been focusing on her because he knew it would make her psychic powers go haywire.
I look over at Five.
And you think this prism thing from your chest can help?
He shrugs in response.
I'm not even sure what it does exactly, only that it helped me. Going after it seems more productive than sitting around here.
Nine claps his hands.
I'm with Five. Let's get the hell out of here.
Marina has been quiet since initially arguing against the Everglades. Now Six reaches over and puts a hand on her arm.
Are you all right with this?
She asks.
Marina nods slowly.
If you believe this is the best way to help them, then I'm with you.
I head down to the parking garage to see the guard off. Sarah won't be budged from John's side, and my dad has gone back to check on the Mogadorian translator. I'm holding a folder full of documents that John had me prepare using Sander's computer. Fake driver's licenses for each of the guard. Some paperwork documenting a phony school trip. The itinerary of their direct flight from Chicago to Orlando. They should be able to travel undetected. I fish John's documents out of the file and stick them in my pocket.
Guess you won't need these,
I say, handing the rest over to Six. I hold on to the file a second too long, and Six ends up having to tug it loose from my hand.
Sorry, just nervous about this.
It's the right move, Sam. It'll be okay.
Nine pats me on the shoulder and goes off to pick out a car to drive to the airport. Five follows him, not bothering with a goodbye. To my surprise, Marina wraps me in a hug.
Take care of them, okay?
She says. Of course, I reply, trying to sound reassuring.
They'll be fine. You guys just hurry back.
Eight nods to me. And then he and Marina follow after Nine. That leaves just Six and me. She's making a show of thumbing through the documents I handed her, but I can tell she's lingering because she wants to say something. Everything's there, I tell her.
I know, just double-checking,
she replies, looking up at me.
We should be back by tomorrow night at the latest.
Be careful, I say.
Thanks,
she says, touching me on the arm.
There's an awkward pause. Neither of us really sure what to do. I wish we could have had just 15 minutes more alone on the rooftop.
I feel like that would have been enough to figure out whatever is going on between us. Now we're standing here, like a couple just back from a really bizarre first date, neither sure what the other is thinking, nor whether it's an appropriate time to make a move. Well, maybe Six knows exactly what I'm thinking. And just doesn't know what to do with that information. I certainly don't have a clue what's going through her mind. I feel like I should say or do something. But then the moment passes. Her hand drops away from my arm, and she turns to join the others. Whatever is between us, it'll have to wait. Nine's penthouse seems even bigger now that it's emptied out. I wander through the deserted halls and lavish rooms, not really sure what to do with myself. I end up going back to Ella's room to check in, just as Sarah is leaving. It's the first time that she's been away from John since he went down. "Your dad is making me eat something," she explains sullenly, looking exhausted from staying awake for the entire night.
"Yeah, he's got this thing about people not starving to death," I reply.
Sarah gives me a weak smile, and I put my hand on her back, guiding her towards the kitchen. She rests her head on my shoulder as we walk.
"We've had so many arguments about one of us getting hurt. It's like the most frequent fight of our relationship."
She laughs bitterly.
"Funny thing is, I always thought it'd be me, not John. He's supposed to be untouchable."
"Jeez, Sarah, you're acting like he's been chopped in half or something.
He'll probably pop awake in an hour and be mad they went on the mission without him."
I try to sound optimistic. Sarah is probably too tired to notice the uncertainty in my voice.
"If he was chopped in half, they could probably heal him," she says. "This is something else. I can see the pain on his face. It's like he's being tortured in front of me. There's nothing I can do about it."
I pour Sarah a glass of water and take some leftover Chinese food out of the fridge. I don't bother heating it up. We eat in silence, picking at cold fried rice and boneless spare ribs straight from the cartons. I repeat the phrase, "He'll be fine," over and over in my head, like a mantra, until I'm confident that I can say it with conviction, even if I'm not entirely convinced it's true. "He'll be fine," I tell Sarah firmly. While Sarah goes back to watch over John and Ella, I try to get some rest in the living room. I guess when you've just recently seen your best friend sucked into a state of perpetual sleep, nap time can be a little nerve-wracking. Still, my body is more exhausted than my anxiety is strong, and I must fall asleep for at least a few hours. The first thing I do upon waking up is check on John and Ella. There's still no change. I wander down to the lecture hall, thinking that some kind of workout will do me good. Maybe if I pick out the noisiest guns in Nine's arsenal to use in target practice, I'll disrupt John and Ella's slumber. I stop through the workshop on my way. It's empty. My dad must be in his room, getting some rest. The tablet is still plugged in, and I can see that 5 blue dots have made it to Florida, currently moving slowly across the southern tip. That's good. It means 6 and the others didn't have any problems using their new fake IDs at the airport, and that there weren't any Mogadorian scouts waiting to pick them off. Everything appears to be going just the way John planned. If only he was awake to see it. I notice something blinking in the corner of one of the computer screens. It's the translator program my dad set up. It must have been on autopilot this entire time. I restore the window, a dialogue box popping up. "Translation complete. Print now." I swallow hard, not sure if it's my place to be the first one viewing these Mogadorian translations, but clicking yes anyway. A printer beneath the desk hisses to life, spitting out the document. I grab the first page before the rest have even finished printing. Some of the words are jumbled or mixed up, making it clear that the translation program is not 100% accurate. But even with the occasional misplaced word, I recognize the document immediately. I've seen it before. I realize that I'm holding my breath, that my fingers have clenched the papers tight enough to wrinkle and bend them. I'm rooted in place, disbelief and fear shutting down my much-needed motor functions. I'm holding in my hands a copy of the notes my father took on the guard's inheritance. Tacked onto the end is the address of the John Hancock Center. Chapter 31. I burst out of the workshop, the door sharply clanging behind me. My palms are sweating, almost like the documents I'm holding are radiating heat. My mind races. What would the Mogadorians be doing with copies of my father's notes? How would they even have gotten them? I think back to dinner that first night, when my dad laid out the details of his long Mogadorian imprisonment. I remember some of the guard seeming suspicious, especially when my dad talked about the tinkering the Mogadorians did with his mind. Nine even came right out and said that it could be a trap. But that wasn't possible. He's my father. We could trust him. I raced down the hallway to my dad's room. I'm not even sure what I'm going to do when I find him. Confront him? Tell him we need to get the hell out of here? His room is empty. I find myself taking a quick glance around. Not even sure what I'm looking for. Some kind of Mogadorian communicator? A Moog English dictionary? Nothing looks out of the ordinary. There has to be a rational explanation for this, right? Hadn't I seen with my own eyes the kind of literal mind games the Mogadorians are capable of? I'd seen Adam use a legacy that was apparently the side effect of the Moogs ripping out the memories from a dead guard. Even now, John and Ella were comatose thanks to some telepathic assault perpetuated by Cetricus Ra. The Mogadorians held onto my dad for years and ran unspeakable experiments on his mind. Was it really outside the realm of possibility that the Moogs could have brainwashed him? My dad might not even be aware they're controlling him. They might have done something to his brain and then let him escape on purpose, knowing that he'd be more valuable out in the world, gathering intelligence. The Moogs could have programmed him in a way that he's secretly reporting to them while he sleeps. I remember reading something about how double agents could be hypnotized into forgetting their own subterfuge. Was that a real article or a comic book? I couldn't remember. Back in the hallway, I yell, "Dad, where are you?" I try to keep my voice normal and steady, because what if he is a Mogadorian spy? I don't want to tip him off.
"In here,"
my dad yells back from Ella in John's room. My dad, the alien spy? Come on, get a grip, Sam. That's the kind of conspiracy theory I might have found in They Walk Among Us. It's ridiculous. More importantly, I know in my heart that it isn't true. So why do I feel so nervous? I stand in the doorway to Ella's room, clutching the translated documents. Sarah has gone to her own room to get some sleep, so it's just him and Bernie Kosar standing watch over John and Ella. BK is curled up, asleep. My dad, idly scratching behind his ears. "What is it, Sam?" he asks. My dad must know by my wide-eyed look that something's wrong. He leaves BK and walks towards me. But I find myself stepping instinctively backwards into the hallway. I'm keeping a safe distance from the loving father who rescued me from a prison cell. Great. I thrust the documents at him. "Why would the Mogadorians have these?" He flips through the papers, turning the pages more rapidly as he realizes what they are.
These are my notes.
I know. How did the Mogadorians get their hands on them? He must realize the implication of my question, because a hurt expression briefly clouds his face.
"Sam, I did not do this,"
he says, trying to sound convincing, but there's a note of uncertainty in his voice. "Can you be sure? What if they did something to you, Dad? Something that you don't remember?"
"No. Impossible," he says, shaking his head, almost as if he's trying to convince himself.
I can tell by his tone that he doesn't truly believe it's impossible. In fact, I think he's frightened by the thought.
"Are the originals still in my room?"
Together, we run back to his room. The notebook is on his bureau, right where it's supposed to be. My dad flips through it, like he's looking for some sign it's been tampered with. His features tighten, like they do when he's trying to remember something. I think he's realizing that he can't trust himself, that the Mogadorians could have done something to him. He turns to me with a grim look on his face.
"If my notes have gotten into Mogadorian hands, we have to assume this place is compromised. You should arm yourself, Sam. Sarah, too."
"What about you?" I ask, my stomach turning over.
I can't be trusted,"
he stammers.
"You should lock me in here until the guard return."
"There has to be another explanation," I say, my voice cracking.
I'm not sure if I really believe that, or if I just want it to be true.
I don't remember leaving, he says, but I suppose my memory isn't worth much at this point.
He drops heavily onto the bed in his room. He folds his hands in his lap and stares down at them. He looks defeated somehow, undermined by both his mind and his son. I start towards the door.
Look, I'm going to go get Sarah and some guns. But I'm not going to lock you in here. Just stay here, okay?
Wait.
He stops me, holding up a hand.
What is that?
I hear it too. A low, rumbling sound coming from the drawer of his nightstand. I get there first, flinging open the drawer. It's the phone he was using to communicate with Adam. The screen is lit up, a phone call coming in from a blocked number. In the corner of the screen, I see that the phone has 19 missed calls. I hold it up to my father. His face lights up, but I feel increasingly nervous. Too much is happening all at once. Feels like the walls are closing in on me. I hit the button and press the phone to my ear, my voice shaky.
Hello?
Malcolm!
The breathless voice on the phone shouts.
Where have you been?
This is Sam,
I correct. A feeling of dread rising in my stomach as I recognize the voice.
Adam, is that you?
My dad jumps up and squeezes my shoulders, excited that Adam is still alive. I wish I could feel relieved, but the way he sounds on the phone, it's like more bad news is on the way.
Sam! Sam! Where's your father?
He's...
Never mind. It doesn't matter.
He shouts.
Listen to me, Sam. You're in Chicago, right? The John Hancock Center? How did you know that? They know, Sam!
Adam yells.
They know, and they're coming for you!
Chapter 32. Hold on! We all lurch to one side as Nine haphazardly steers our fanboat. Exactly what it sounds like, a small boat propelled by a giant fan on the back around an overturned log floating in the murky brown swamp water. Eight nearly loses his balance and has to grab on to my arm to steady himself. He flashes me a sheepish smile as he lets me go to swat a mosquito. The air is thick and humid, buzzing with insects that can be heard even above the roar of our boat's propeller. This place smells of rich soil, of nature overgrown. Look at that! Eight shouts to be heard over the boat. I peer over the side to where a massing of lily pads is disturbed by something drifting through the water. At first, I think it's another log, but then I notice the rough scales of a tail swaying across the water and know it's an alligator. Keep your hands inside the ride, Eight yells. I watch as the alligator disappears into an outgrowth of trees to our left. I can see why Five thought the Everglades would be a safe place to hide his inheritance. It's a maze of tall grasses and muddy water, deserted except for the bugs and the lurking animals. We're traveling down what is basically a road in the water, a place where the dense sawgrass and trees that sprout up on either side of us part to allow boat traffic. Not that there's anyone else out here. We haven't seen a single human being since picking up our boat from the rental place an hour ago. Even that was just a ramshackle cabin stuck between the end of a country road and the edge of a swamp. We had our pick of three rusted fanboats lashed to the rickety dock. The solitary man living out there, sunburned and smelling like a combination of alcohol and jet fuel, hiccuped his way through a tutorial on boat operation before accepting some cash in exchange for a dog-eared map of the area and the keys to the boat. He didn't ask any questions, which we were all thankful for. It's the local man's map that Six is concerning herself with. She's comparing it to the map of the Everglades that we printed off the internet, the one 5 marked with the location of his chest. She keeps switching between our map and the smudged but more detailed map of local tributaries and bayou backwaters. She holds the papers away from her, annoyed. "I can't make sense of this," she grumbles.
"Don't worry about it," Nine replies, steering us forward towards the sunset. "Five said he knows where we're going. Let him be useful for a change."
I glance to the sky, looking for Five. He flew off about 15 minutes ago, claiming he could better find his chest from above. The edge of the sky is starting to turn a shade of pink that I'd normally find beautiful, but out here seems somehow ominous. "I don't mean to sound like a chicken," I say warily, pushing a wet strand of hair behind my ear. "But I seriously don't want to be out here after the sun sets."
"Me neither," adds 8, flicking the map in 6's hands. "Especially if our esteemed navigator doesn't know how to get us back to civilization."
6 narrows her eyes at 8, but doesn't reply. 9 just laughs. Huge sweat stains darken his shirt and bugs buzz around him incessantly, but he doesn't seem to notice. In fact, 9 seems to be enjoying this. The humidity, the stickiness, the sense of danger. It's his natural element.
"I was thinking we might go camping after," he says.
8 and I groan. If there weren't alligators drifting around in the water beneath us, I'd definitely take this opportunity to splash 9. I look to the skies again, keeping my eyes peeled for 5. "I'm sure he'll be back soon," I say. There's no reason not to be optimistic. So far, this mission has run smoothly with no sign of any trouble. I still don't feel right about leaving John and Ella behind, but the others were right. There's nothing we could do for them in Chicago. I haven't quite reached the levels of enthusiasm 9 has, but it definitely feels better to be out here doing something, searching for a way to help our friends and win this war. Just as long as we don't get lost in this swamp. No good could come from that. A shadow passes overhead. 5. He hovers over the boat for a moment before gently dropping down beside us. He's dripping sweat, his white t-shirt soaked through. 9 snickers.
"Probably gonna lose some weight if we hang down here long enough, huh, big boy?"
5 grits his teeth, pulling his wet shirt away from his body self-consciously. We're all sweaty and gross, but for some reason, 9 just can't resist picking on 5. I had dared to hope that maybe the game of capture the flag helped them work out some of their issues, but there's still tension festering between them. "Ignore him," I say to 5. "Did you find your chest?" 5 nods, pointing in the direction we're already going. "There's a patch of solid ground about a mile farther. It's there." 9 sighs. "Why didn't you just grab the chest and fly it back here, man?" 5 smirks at 9. "You didn't listen to the plan, did you? We voted that you should handle all the manual labor and grunt work." "Huh?" Confused, 9 looks over at 8. "Is he serious?" 8 shrugs, playing along. 6 makes an exasperated noise. "Just drive the damn boat, 9.
"Aye, aye, Captain," 9 says, wiggling his fingers. "One chest coming right up."
6 turns her gaze to 5. She's been more quiet than usual. "Why didn't you just grab the chest?" she asks sharply. 5 shrugs.
"It's getting dark, and it's a good place to rest if we need to."
"See?" 9 shouts, delighted.
"Camping!"
"No way," says 8, shaking his head vehemently.
Drive this thing faster so we can get out of here.
Nine accelerates the boat,
spray kicking up over the side as a result. I guess where five leads us could charitably be described as an island. Really, it's just a pile of mud in the middle of the swamp. The support system for one massive and gnarled tree that looks like it has been growing since the dawn of time. The tree's roots are so huge and outstretched that Nine has to drive the boat up cautiously, not wanting to get stuck on any of them. We climb out of the boat, our feet squishing through mud and slipping across the uneven protrusions of the tree. There's a ring of tall grass growing from the water around us, and the tree's branches above are so numerous and thick that the entire little island is thrown into shadow almost as soon as you step on it. It's actually almost 10 degrees cooler here than it was on the water. This is actually a pretty great spot, I tell Five. Five's chest puffs out a little at the rare compliment. Yeah, I camped here one night. This old tree is amazing. Figured I wouldn't have any problems finding it again. Congratulations, grumbles Nine, swatting at a bug on his neck. So where's your damn chest? Five leads us right to the base of the tree. Under our feet is a complicated lattice of roots. It's like the tree is a fist plunged into the earth, and the roots are its fingers, mud squeezing out from in between the tree's tight grasp. Five kneels down under a knot of roots, a place where they've bunched up a bit, almost like a knuckle. He reaches underneath the roots where a soft pocket of mud waits. It's under here, Five says, feeling around. Almost got it. The mud makes a wet sucking noise when Five pulls the chest free, as if it's reluctant to give up our prize. Five kneels in front of it, wiping muck off the familiar wooden surface. Eight taps on my shoulder and points to a place where the tall grass is parting. I can see the flat head and yellow eyes of an alligator. Maybe the same one as before. Looks like someone's hungry, Eight jokes. Is he following us? I ask, partly kidding around, but also a little creeped out. I inch closer to Eight. Lots of gators down here, says Five absently, hefting his chest up. You talk to animals, don't you? I ask Nine. Tell that beast we don't want any trouble. Maybe I'll keep it as a pet, or make a sweet-ass coat out of it, Nine replies, squinting as he focuses on the approaching animal. Something in his face suddenly changes. Hold up. A second alligator's head appears next to the first, and then, seconds later, a third head also emerges from the muck. At first, I think we're being stalked by a pack of gators, if such a thing is even possible. But then, the three heads rise out of the water as one, a thick, scale-covered neck connecting them all to a single body. The scales disappear beneath a soaked coat of oily black fur on the beast's torso, droplets of water violently shaking loose as it stretches a pair of leathery bat wings. It ends up standing almost 15 feet tall on a pair of almost humanoid legs. It hunches forward, six pairs of jaundiced eyes staring at us hungrily. Look out! Shouts Six, just as the creature flaps its wings and takes to the air. The creature looms in the air over me. It's funny the things you notice in a moment like that. The monster's feet are huge, curled talons extending from each foot's three toes as well as from the heels. But the pads of the monster's feet look almost soft, a pair of S-shaped scars carved into the tissue there, like some Mogadorian scientist signed his work. I see all that in the moment before it tries to stomp down on me.
Watch out!
8 grabs me around the waist, and we teleport backwards. The mutant gator's clawed toes shear a chunk out of the root I was standing on.
How the hell did they find us?
9 snarls, extending his pipe staff.
I don't see any Moogs,
I shout, spinning around, trying to take in the entire swamp.
Could it be alone? I'll go ask.
9 charges in. The beast snaps at him with one of its 3 mouths. 9 brings his pipe staff up and jams it right into the closest mouth, knocking out a couple of yellow fangs. With one head roaring in pain, the monster lashes out with a wing, forcing 9 backwards. 5 drops his chest on the ground and unlocks it. 6 grabs his shoulder.
What the hell?
She yells.
You didn't see this thing when you scouted?
It came from underwater. How could I see it? 5's voice is calm. He doesn't seem rattled at all, unlike how John described him in their last battle. Don't worry, he continues. I've got just the thing in here.
A little help?
9 shouts as he jumps away from one of the monster's snapping mouths. 8 teleports right above the creature's 3 heads. He kicks it hard in one of its snouts, then teleports away so he's side by side with 9. The thing lets loose a frustrated roar, flapping its wings and trying to take to the air. 9 and 8 separate, trying to flank the beast. As 5 rummages through his chest, 6 thrusts her hands in the air.
Marina, watch my back while I do this.
I hear the first droplets of a rainstorm working their way through the foliage. 5 pulls some kind of leather sleeve out of his chest. He slides it over his forearm. When he flexes, a sleek 1-foot blade extends from the underside of his wrist. 5 grins. Missed you, he says to the sleeve contraption, the blade sliding back down when he flexes again.
Let's hurry up on that lightning, 6,
yells 9. The monster is bearing down on him. It's everything he can do to get his staff up, deflecting a series of bites from the trio of fanged mouths. Backpedaling blind, 9 trips over a branch and goes toppling onto his butt. The beast is about to leap right on top of him when 8 shapeshifts, assuming the form of a massive half-man, half-boar, one of the avatars of Vishnu, I presume. He grabs the creature by its alligator tail and yanks it backwards, keeping it from devouring 9. The beast swivels around and sinks its teeth into 8's shoulder. He bellows through his boar snout, and his form begins to flicker. I can see he's having trouble keeping his concentration with the pain from the bite.
8!
I scream. I want to go to him, to heal him, but I can't leave 6 while she's focusing on creating a storm.
Go help him, she says through gritted teeth. I'm good to go.
I race forward, intent on getting to 8. Before the flying gator can take another chunk out of him, a lightning bolt slices down from the heavens. It strikes the creature and knocks it flat, the thing convulsing and smoking. It's raining harder now, 6 really amping up the storm. 9 is back on his feet. He barrels forward, while the beast is still struggling to get its 2 legs under it. 9 bludgeons the creature with his staff, but the blows hardly make a dent in the scale-covered hide. With 9 back on the attack, 8 staggers away from the monster, still in his Vishnu form. He transforms back to normal when I reach him, and I can see deep and jagged lacerations covering his right shoulder. I press my hands to 8's shoulder, let the icy feeling flow through me and into him, and I watch as his wounds close up. I could kiss you, 8 says. After we kill this thing, maybe, I reply. The monster rears back and swings one of its leathery wings at 9, knocking him backwards. As soon as 9 is out of the way, 6 calls down 2 more lightning strikes. The lightning knocks the beast down again and tears a hole in the membrane of its wing, but it just struggles back to his feet again and roars. It seems like we're only making it angrier.
What does it take to stop this fucker? Shouts 9.
A high-pitched whistle fills the air, so loud and sharp that it causes my skin to crawl, like fingernails on a chalkboard. I spin around to see 5 blowing into an intricate flute carved from solid obsidian. As the shrill note fills the air, he stares unblinkingly at the monster. All at once, it's like the fight goes out of the thing. It folds its huge wings around its body and sinks to the ground, its 3 heads tucked against his chest, almost like it's bowing.
Whoa, breathes 8.
See, says 5, lowering the whistle and glancing around.
Easy. If you had that thing the entire time, why didn't you use it?
9 snaps.
I thought you might want a workout,
5 says, smiling coldly at 9. 6 shakes her head.
Would one of you just kill that thing so we can get out of here?
Gladly, says 5, his skin turning into glittering steel. He takes 2 steps towards the genuflecting beast, but stops right next to 6.
I made the damn thing,
5 says absently. The least I can do is put it down.
You what?
I ask with disbelief. 5's steel-plated fist shoots forward with a force I've never seen from him before, hitting 6 with an uppercut. The force sends 6's entire body into the air and she lands at my feet. I can see her eyes are rolled into the back of her head, and twin tendrils of blood are leaking out of her nostrils. A concussion at best, a fractured skull at worst. Instinctively, I move to heal her, but when I try to crouch down, something hits me in the chest. Not hard, not even with enough force to knock the wind out of me, but I can't move forward. It's telekinesis. 5 is gently keeping me at bay. I look up at him, confused tears filling my eyes. 8 breaks the stunned moment of silence, yelling,
"Why'd you do that?"
He's drowned out by 9's scream. 5's body has taken on the consistency of rubber, and his arm stretches like a tentacle, wrapping twice around 9's throat. 9 struggles, but 5 lifts him off his feet with ease. His arm stretches further, hanging 9 10 feet off the ground, and then plunges downward. He dunks 9 into the swamp and holds him there, drowning him. Both 8 and I are frozen as 5 turns to look at us. His expression is disconcertingly friendly, considering his stretched-out appendage is currently holding 9 underwater and 6 is lying unconscious at my feet, thanks to a vicious sucker punch. I can see vibrations spread up 5's arm from where 9 must be punching at it, trying to free himself. The blows must not be giving 5 any pain because he hardly seems to notice. He sits down on his chest and looks at us.
The 3 of us should probably talk, 5 says calmly.
Chapter 33. The connection to Adam abruptly goes dead. I glance down at the phone screen, but Adam called from a blocked number. There's no way to call him back. Wherever he was, Adam sounded like he was moving fast, practically shouting over the wind whipping around in the background, on the run and sounding panicked. I'm the exact opposite, rooted in place and feeling almost numb. What would John do in this situation? Get moving. That's what. I shove the phone into my back pocket and move past my dad, heading for the hallway. He said the Mogadorians know where we are and that they're on their way. We need to get out of here, now. I call back to my dad. When I glance over my shoulder, he's still standing next to the bed. Come on, I say. What are you waiting for?
What if...
My dad squeezes the bridge of his nose.
What if I can't be trusted?
Oh, right. The whole possibility that my dad could be some kind of unwitting double agent for the Mogadorians. There has to be a better explanation for how his notes fell into their hands. Maybe he's not sure if he can trust himself. Maybe he's worried that his memory is failing, or working against him. It doesn't matter. I make up my mind right then and there. I trust him. Remember outside of the Dulce base, when I wanted to rush back inside to go help the guard fight? You told me there would be other moments to make myself useful to the Lorik. Well, I think this is one of those times. I trust you, Dad. I can't do this without you. He nods solemnly. Without another word, he reaches under his bed and pulls out the rifle he used to take down that monster in Arkansas, pumping a shell into place.
Did Adam tell you how long we have?
He asks. As if in answer, the building shakes, all the lights flickering. An engine flares outside, the noise above us and dangerously close, followed by a sharp metallic grinding. Something just landed on the roof. Apparently not long at all. We dart into the hallway, where Sarah has just emerged from her room. Her eyes widen as she notices my dad carrying a rifle.
What was that sound? She asks. What's happening?
The Moogs are here, I answer.
Oh no,
Sarah says, backing towards the room where John and Ella are laid out defenseless. From the hallway, I have a clear view of the floor-to-ceiling windows that line the penthouse living room. A half-dozen ropes come slithering down from the rooftops, the Mogadorians rappelling down the side of the building.
I have to get to John, Sarah says.
I grab her by the wrist. We don't stand a chance if we don't get to the weapons. The windows shatter, blown open by a synchronized series of blasts from Mogadorian cannons. A rush of cold air flows through the penthouse. The Moogs swing inside, swiftly detach from the rappelling wires, and start scanning the space around them for targets. They're in the living room, standing between us and the penthouse elevator, our only exit. I'm surprised there aren't more of them. If I was attacking a hideout for the guard, I'd have sent an entire army. It's almost as if they aren't expecting a lot of resistance. The three of us duck back into my dad's room.
I'll get to John and Ella, says my dad. You two make a break for the lecture hall.
I can hear the Moogs moving out of the living room, starting down our hallway.
Here they come. Let's go on three. One.
Before I hit two, a ferocious roar erupts from the hallway, immediately answered by wild Mogadorian blaster fire. I poke my head into the hallway in time to see Bernie Kosar, in the shape of a grizzly bear, mauling a pair of Mogadorians. I've forgotten all about BK. Maybe things aren't as desperate as they seem.
Go,
my dad shouts as he makes a break towards Ella's room.
Get weapons and we'll hold them here.
BK lunges from Moog to Moog, tearing through them with his claws, tossing aside the furniture that they try to hide behind. He takes a few blaster shots in the side, and the air fills with the smell of burned hair, but that only seems to make him angrier. Crouched in the doorway of Ella's room, my dad takes aim and starts picking off Moogs. Sarah and I take off in the opposite direction, towards the lecture hall and the armory. Behind me, I can hear blaster fire sizzling into the walls, my dad's rifle answering back. We have to be quick. More will surely be dropping in from the roof and they won't be able to hold them off forever. Suddenly, the bedroom door on my right swings open. I have a second to feel the rush of cool air from the broken window. And then there's a Mogadorian on top of me. He drives his shoulder into my side, pinning me up against the wall. His forearm presses into my throat, and he puts his pale face close to mine, his lifeless, black eyes filling my vision.
Human,
the Moog hisses.
Tell me where the girl is and I'll kill you quick.
Before I can ask which girl he's talking about, Sarah cracks the Mogadorian over the head with an empty vase. The Moog shakes off the blow and spins on Sarah. An anger wells up in me. For all that time in captivity, for what they've done to John and Ella. I grab the handle of the Moog sword and rip it loose from his sheath. With a scream, I drive it through his chest, turning him to ash.
Whoa!
Sarah cheers. I can hear glass shattering from all around the penthouse. Doors to bedrooms all along the hallway are thrown open, and Moogs come charging into sight, cutting me and Sarah off from my dad and Bernie Kosar. I remember thinking the empty penthouse was spooky before, but this is horrifying. I've lost sight of my dad at the other end of the hall. I can still hear his rifle working, the shots getting more and more frequent. I hear a loud crash, the sound of something tipping over in Ella's room.
You're after the girl?
I yell, getting their attention, hopefully taking some of the pressure off my dad.
She's this way!
Sarah and I sprint into the workshop, 10 or so Moogs charging down the hallway after us. Together we shove over a stack of old appliances and engine parts that are next to the doorway, Sanders' accumulated clutter coming in handy. A Moog tries to force open the door, but it's jammed up against all the crap on the floor. That'll slow him down for a second, I say.
Do they think I'm this girl they're after?
Sarah asks breathlessly.
Or do you think they're here for Ella?
A chunk of the workshop door explodes in a burst of blaster fire, hot splinters flecking across my cheek and almost into my eye. I guess our second is up. Sarah grabs me by the arm, and we stagger through the workshop, the door behind us being pulverized by the invading Moogs. A stray blast hits the floor between us, knocking us apart, and sending Sarah falling over a table. More blasts are getting through now. I duck low and grab Sarah's hand, helping her stand up.
I'm okay,
she yells, and we run, hunched over, towards the lecture hall. The workshop door is now just a smoking hole in the wall, thanks to all the Mogadorians shooting. They're shoving in, tripping over the junk we knocked over, but advancing all the same. Next to me, the monitor that's displaying the location of the guard explodes in a shower of sparks, a Moog blaster just narrowly missing me.
How are we going to fight this many off?
Sarah yells as we burst into the lecture hall.
I've been practicing, but not against 10 targets at once.
We've got the home field advantage. Inside the lecture hall proper, Sarah makes a break for the gun rack, and I climb into the lectern. The first Moogs burst into the room just as I fire up the lecture hall's programming, keying up one of Sanders' old training routines, the one with difficulty marked insanity. The Moogs aren't even paying any attention to me just yet, seated behind the metallic console tapping buttons. They're more focused on Sarah. Even if they realize she's not the girl they're looking for, she's still the most obvious threat. Out in the open and pointing a pair of pistols at the Moogs. Obvious threat, and also an easy target.
Sarah, to your left,
I shout, raising a block of cover from the floor for her to hide behind. She dives to safety, just as the Mogadorians open fire. Smoke starts filling the room from the nozzles along the walls. Some of the Moogs look confused. Most are only interested in blasting away at Sarah. A few shots begin ricocheting off the front of the lectern, and I hunker down in the seat, trying to make myself small. I hope this thing is strong enough to withstand some blaster fire. Above the shooting, I can hear the lecture hall whirring to life. A half dozen panels along all four walls slide open, turrets loaded with ball bearings coming into view.
Stay down,
I yell at Sarah,
It's starting!
A crossfire erupts through the lecture hall.